This is Andrew Samuels, March 22, 1991, Politics and Depth Psychology, Tape 1 of 2.
This may sound a little bit rash for somebody who's suffering from a throat infection picked up on the aeroplane, but hearing how fuzzy that was, I'm actually going to move this forward and do this without the mic. That really was it brought back absolutely awful memories of university days. Now, if I put this... if I put this here, will it still pick me up enough for the recording? Yes? Thank you. Ideally, I should now be unamplified. Am I unamplified or amplified? Thank you very much for inviting me. I'll begin with a few words from the Austrian writer Robert Musil, to serve as a kind of apologia for this work. He wrote, "The author is more modest and less obliging than the title of this piece might lead one to infer. Indeed, I'm convinced that not only what I say is wrong, but that what you will say against it will be wrong as well. Nevertheless, a beginning must be made, for the truth is to be found not in the middle of such a subject, but around the outside, like a sack which changes shape every time a new opinion is stuffed in it, but grows firmer all the while." Papers are often written months in advance, and this could be a disadvantage for a paper on politics. However, I've also found this practical reality a very useful and salutary reminder of the limited role we depth psychologists have played in the political happenings of our century. Our engagement with the political has to be indirect, reflective, part of a multidisciplinary project, yet passionate, pained, and at ease with uncertainty. So I have resisted the temptation to rework this whole paper to make it up to the minute. It isn't a paper on the Gulf War. It's a paper on depth psychology and politics. But when I found that something that I'd written touched on the great events of the day, I have developed the idea a bit. Actually, I was amazed at the numerous relevances and cross-references that I found in my own text. For example, what I'm going to say about bargaining, negotiating, and the market economy has a bearing on other complicated geopolitical and social situations. My worry then, having expanded the paper, is that it is just a touch too long, and I apologize in advance. My theme is the depth psychology of political process, focusing on the psychology of nonviolent political change and conflict resolution. It is a contribution to the long-standing ambition of depth psychology to develop a form of political and cultural analysis that would, in Freud's words, understand the riddles of the world. Now, it has to be admitted that there is an equally long-standing reluctance on the part of the non-psychological community to accept the many and varied ideas and suggestions concerning politics that have been offered by analysts of every persuasion. And I don't believe this reluctance can all be put down to their resistance. Don't you agree there is really something offensive about reductive interpretations of complex socio-political problems in exclusively psychological terms? For example, a leading Kleinian analyst in London published a piece in The Guardian in which she talked about the phallic symbolism of Tomahawk cruise missiles being targeted down ventilator shafts. Yeah, but it's equally obscene to hear it all put down to some archetypal image, pattern, God, RAs, whatever. You know, it's all really the same kind of inflation on the part of shrinks, this psychological reductionism. So when people reject it and say it's far-fetched, say it leaves out social, economic, political, historical, and cultural factors, I have a lot of sympathy with those people, and I don't think they're just being resistant. Well, what do I mean by politics, a word which I'm using a lot tonight? I mean the arrangements within a single culture or between the countries of the world for the organization and distribution of resources and power, especially economic power. Economic and political power also includes control of processes of information and representation, as well as the use of physical force and possession of vital resources such as land, food, water, and oil. On a more personal level, power, political power, reflects the ability a person has to choose freely whether to act and what action to take in a given situation. So you've got the public power and the private power issues. And politics, this word, this idea, also refers to the interplay between the personal and public dimensions of power. Because you see, there is a connection between economic power in society and power as expressed on the domestic, private level, between people, in families, between men and women, between parents and children. Now, where the public and the private, the political and the personal, intersect, I think there is a special role for depth psychology, especially Jungian psychology, in relation to processes of political change and transformation. Those of us, all of us here, involved in depth psychology, need to struggle towards a new psychological valuing of the potential of political engagement itself. Involvement in the external world and passionate political commitments are as psychologically valuable to the individual as an interior perspective. Involvement in politics can certainly be a means of avoiding personal conflicts or acting out such conflicts. Clinicians who are here will recognize this. Some patients use politics to avoid their personal shit. But political involvement should not be damned across the board like this. Political involvement is also a means of expressing what is best in humans, acknowledging the fact of our social being, acknowledging that we are not the isolated, solipsistic monads that some psychological theories might lead us to believe we are. I would say that a more evolved attitude to politics on the part of the individual is something that should be worked on in every consulting room or clinical office. Analysts might begin to work out a model of the psyche that enables us to refer to a person's level of political development, to their having a political drive, and hence to their being a political level of the psyche. In clinical practice, such a model would enable us to generate new readings of personal and collective political imagery. We may even find that there is a politics of imagery, a politics of imagery. As you know from the flyer that was sent round, the title of the paper is taken from some lines of the Russian futurist poet Vladimir Mayakovsky, written in the 1920s. Art is not a mirror to reflect the world, but a hammer with which to shape it. I think depth psychology has to do both, has to use the mirror and the hammer, and I try to do it in a mixture of styles, ranging on the one hand from exegetical sobriety to playfulness to something quite frankly irrational and even a bit mad. Now that introductory section was about depth psychology and politics and their relationship. And now in the next section, I want to look at certain very important developments in the world of politics. It has never been more difficult than it is today to make a psychological analysis of political process, because in our time, every element in culture is undergoing fragmentation and balkanization. It's become harder and harder to see what political arrangements do hold our culture together. Yet, people have risen to the challenge of these anxiety-provoking ideas of fragmentation, fracture, and complexity. Our sense of fragmentation, fracture, and complexity seems to be healing as well as wounding to a sense of political and social empowerment. For, amidst the tragic anomie and baffling atomization of the modern world, amidst the dreadful conformism of so-called international architecture, like this room in a way, which could be anywhere, amidst the dreadful conformism of international architecture, telecommunications and cuisine, amidst the sense of oppression and fear of a horrific future, amidst war itself, there is an equally fragmented, fractured, and complex attempt at a resacralization of the culture going on, a resacralization. There are many surface signs of this resacralization: new age or new times thought, concern for the general quality of life, green politics, feminism, the human potential movement, finding God in the new physics, and so on. I would even include trying to engage depth psychology with politics. I don't want to leave myself off the list. In fairness, I don't assume that only left-leaning, so-called progressive political and religious movements partake in this resacralization. Born-again Christians, Islamic fundamentalists, and Lubavitch Jews are part of the same trend. And in different forms, of course, resacralization is also a good way to describe what has been happening in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. I've just come back from a couple of weeks lecturing in Russia, and I'll talk about it later if you like. Now, clearly, I think that all these developments that I call resacralization are extremely important and worthwhile. They contain within them the elements of successful resolution of our most vexing dilemmas. But, I also think they are at serious risk of failing. These spontaneous movements are surface signs that there is something politically transformative going on. I want to suggest that resacralization is our contemporary attempt to shift a sense of holiness into the secular and material world. And that's why, for many people, maybe some of you here, resacralization has indeed meant a frank return to religion. Sometimes this is established religion, sometimes archaic or apparently archaic religion. Now, as a depth psychologist, I have to engage with resacralization in a special way. In addition to believing in resacralization or supporting resacralization, I have to try to pick up on the psychology of what is going on. I have to try to make something psychological, but not too psychological, out of a host of specific cultural impressions. The idea is to bring something up and out that is already there. So these words of mine about resacralization are intended to be a description of it, a chronicle of it, an interpretation of it, not a sermon about it or advocacy of it. In a way, you know, this is just the same attitude as you have to have in clinical analysis. You can't put something into the patient. You can only bring out what is there. So I'm not, at this moment, as a psychologist, trying to put something into resacralization. My job as a psychologist is to try to bring out something that is already there. And speaking as a depth psychologist and analyst, there is one specific impression I want to share with you. This is of a growing collective sense of disgust in both Western culture and the once communist states. It's a disgust with the political world in whose making we have participated. Disgust is lurking alongside the shallowness and cruelty of much of modern life. Our subjectivity is full of it. Our culture, and not just our culture, is longing to atone for its social injustices and the sense of disgust it feels for them, longing to be able to think good thoughts about itself and rid itself of the depressive preoccupation with its own destructiveness, longing for a resacralized politics. You see, we're already full of guilty contempt for capitalism and for what passed for socialism in the East. But there's a lack of any ritual by which we could make repentance on a cultural scale. Lacking ritual, lacking a symbolic language with which to express our unease and disgust and our desire to atone, we make a split. We make a split between the constructive and the cheating sides of capitalism and the market economy, preferring to see and hence to support only one side or the other. Now, I think that if we don't do something about this split in our image of the market economy and our attitude to the market economy, then, hard though it is to face, resacralization, so ardently sought by so many, will not take place. It won't work. I'd like to explore the contents of this deadly split. On the negative side, we have Kiliast fantasies of an apocalyptic end, whether by nuclear conflagration, AIDS pandemic, or the greenhouse effect. Certainly, these anxieties are rooted in reality, but taken as fantasies, they are the deepest signs of our own self-punishing contempt for ourselves. We think we deserve to perish like that, and we may even wish it. And on the positive side of the split, well, you know about this, we tend to extol capitalism as the source of the material benefits that we enjoy today, as the only economic system that seems to work, and as the means of the destruction of the so-called evil empire. Now, we can see this negative-positive split very clearly in relation to the market economy. Actually, I think the same kind of split lies behind people's diverse attitudes to the Gulf War as well. The split in relation to the market economy works like this. Is the market economy a socially divisive rich man's charter, as even supporters of it, like Kevin Phillips, are beginning to say in the United States? And in Britain, it was free market economics and people's disgust with those that were partly behind the turfing out of Mrs. Thatcher. Or is the market economy, the free market, the road to freedom and dignity, as many, if not most, now seem to think in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union? Or is the market economy simply the best available synthesis or compromise? Or, and this is the line I intend to take, is the market economy both a negative and a positive phenomenon at the same time? with the negative and the positive verdicts, each having a distinct psychology of its own that resists compromise. Now, in this way of looking at the market economy, not only are our negative and positive images of it not split off from each other, but they each guarantee the existence of the other. So, there'll be no chance of our realizing the positive features of the market economy without our accepting the simultaneous presence of the negative features of the market economy. You see, it's terribly easy, and Jungians will have absolutely no problem with it, in rejecting the Manichaean, crude, good or bad, split approach in which the market is simply divided. You know, you love it, you hate it, a split like that isn't good. But the apparently reasonable approach that attempts a balanced, averaged out view of the market is almost as problematic, psychologically speaking. In the so-called balanced approach, which is supposed to heal the splits, you see, there's a real difficulty, and the difficulty is in incorporating the undoubtedly unfair and ruthless features of free market economics, and of seeing how they have to be present, for the benefits of the market to be available. They're not unfortunate byproducts of the market. According to this psychological analysis, they are its sine qua non, its without which not, and they can't be ameliorated. I'm saying that we need to know more about the psychology of the market as a positive phenomenon and about the psychology of the market as a negative phenomenon. You see, what I'm really saying is this. Nobody here is going to really buy into good or bad. But our whole training and ethos as Jungians is to synthesize, to bring together. I'm suggesting there's another way to deal with a good-bad split, and that is to really develop the good, really develop the bad, and see how they interact. And my thesis here is if you do that, you'll see that the so-called bad side guarantees something about the so-called good side. So it's then a terrific mistake to see the bad side as something unfortunate. It's actually something, hard though it is to accept, absolutely necessary. Our inability to stay in emotional contact with the psychologically distinct and separate images of the market makes it difficult to work on the psychological issues of resacralization that really are central to any economic and political change. And here, I am absolutely sure that economics can be, should be, the psychological focus. And later in the talk, in order to concentrate on splits within the image of the market economy, I will enlist the aid of the myth of Hermes to help us to hold on to both sides, positive and negative, enthusiasm and disgust of our evaluation of the market economy. That really concludes another section of the paper. What I've been doing in that section is to try to tease out a depth psychological angle on resacralization. If you like, it's a kind of assessment. Will it work? If not, why not? And my worry about whether resacralization will work and all those movements that I mentioned will come to fruition, there will be a flowering out of those seeds. My worry is that they haven't really addressed questions of market economics, and that quite frankly, most of the movements that I've subsumed under this word resacralization do indulge in a kind of good-bad split about the market. I think there's a psychological problem here. A few words about Mr. Gorbachev. Yes, I do better.
There's been a play on London. It was a terrific hit.
And I beg your pardon. Sorry. There's been a big hit on the London stage called Moscow Girl. And they took it for one night only to Moscow. And it was, you know, you couldn't get in. It was just absolutely overwhelmingly packed. And in this play, the theme really is about the economic restructuring of the Soviet Union and the troubles about that and the relationship and quarrels between Gorbachev and Yeltsin. And I was amazed to find this particular passage I'm going to do for you, because the Russians found this passage extremely provocative and central to their concerns, and it kind of fits with some of the things I was saying in the paper. And basically, what's happening on stage is that Gorbachev and Yeltsin are confronting each other. And there's a kind of weird Greek chorus of three Kremlin cleaning ladies. Yeltsin says to Gorbachev, "Have you fixed the date for our first ever general election?" And Gorbachev says to Yeltsin, "Have you decided on the name of your new party? Is it going to be the Christian Democrats or the Russian Orthodox Christian Democrats or the Free Market Democrats or the National Socialist Russian Memory Party?" Yeltsin smiles and says, "I love it when they're scared." They both smile. Yeltsin offers a hand, Gorbachev offers his, and Yeltsin says, "We're on the same side, you know. It's me you need, not the dead forces of the past. Together, we could transform this country. Russia alone would become a paradise, the California of Europe." Their hands freeze and fall, says the stage direction. Gorbachev says, "Look, there goes your mouth again, Boris. We must have no illusions about the free market. There will be social explosions if we put 15 million people out of work." Yeltsin, "People would accept temporary unemployment if they trust the leadership." Gorbachev, "Don't you have any sense of the dangers involved? What if the people don't accept it? Will you give our soldiers the orders to open fire on millions of workers rioting for jobs?" And then Kremlin leaders, Yeltsin says, "Let's ask them." Zoya, one of them, says, "My flat's been sold. I wake up one morning and find I've got a new landlady. Is this perestroika?" Yeltsin says, "Tell me, Zoya, are you in favor of the free market?" Zoya says, "Yes." Gorbachev asks her, "Are you in favor of everyone's right to work?" All three of them say, "Yes, yes, yes." Yeltsin, "Are you in favor of greater wealth in this country?" Zoya, "Yes." Gorbachev, "And in favor of a new middle class, 50 times better off than you?" The two women look at each other, they're angry. Zoya, "No." Katya, "No." Lena, "No." The two men look at each other in silence. Get it? That's what they're talking about. They don't have either a psychological structure or a political structure to cope with what's gone on here. But this is what we'll do.
We're going to talk about Brecht and the announcement. You did mention Brecht.
Yeah. Let me just two lines about Brecht. If one's considering how to make analysis, which is an essentially private sort of business, involving a lot of emotion, into something public and personal, a public and less personal, then Brecht is a very interesting thing to study, Brecht's problems, as he struggled to make the theatre less of an affective, empathic narrative in which the audience is invited to identify with the hero, into something much more episodic and argumentative, making political and social points. So what I did, and it's going to be in the book when the book comes out, which is going to be for a long time, what I basically did is to draw some parallels here between the way in which Brecht dealt with his problems of making his theatre more political, and the problems we've got to face as we try to make Jungian psychology more political. And for example, the alienation effect, distanciation, all these techniques that Brecht used, I've tried to develop some analytical parallels, because I wanted to make my ideas relevant to clinical practice as well as everything else. But that's Brecht in 2 minutes. Sorry. The Bible will end that too. Well, the Bible was in Vancouver. Yes.
Could you tell us how this character that you were describing here differs from Shadows?
Do people hear the question? Could I say how the trickster, as I've been describing him, is different from the shadow? In many, many ways. You see, to say that the trickster, if you were going to say that the trickster and the shadow are in some way connected or conflated like that, then you're taking a judgmental attitude towards the trickster. And my basic take here is to lift off the judgmental shackles on the trickster and understand him as a metaphor for all kinds of things to do with politics. You see, I think the shadow does come in when you get a kind of false tricksterism, which may sound a contradiction in terms, of our politicians today, when they, as I said in the paper, lie and cheat for reasons. Then it's shadow, shadowy. But trickster, as a metaphor for the political process itself, is simply lying and cheating. It's not, therefore, quite the same as the shadow side of politics. You could almost say that tricky politicians are a mutant version of the tricksterism that really does lie at the heart of politics. So no, I don't like the idea that the shadow, with the judgmental overtone of that, is the way to get hold of trickster. However, this is the point. The fact that you ask the question, and are probably not just speaking for yourself, but maybe other people have the same kind of idea, does illustrate the problem we've got. You see, we are apparently addicted to an account of politics couched in the language of maturity, of realism, of seriousness. And what I'm trying to say is there's another language for politics altogether, which is weird, which is irrational, which is impulsive, which is not at all mature, and yet is hard-edged, is moral, and is, or could be, effective. Do you want to come back?
Well, I think in terms of economic inequality, it's like, I think in terms of the migrant workers or people in the lower economic classes, well, I was thinking in terms of economic inequalities that you were mentioning, and I think in terms of migrant farm workers, just to look at some examples, and people, homeless people, and the trickster there is that people are depending on them about them, so therefore they're just blind to them or whatever. The trickster is a phenomenon of the shadow, in that sense.
I'm not sure I agree, but the point about economic inequality is that what is in our collective shadow about it is that we're hopelessly in love with it, which means we are hopelessly in love with indignity, cruelty, unfairness, etc. And I think we better realize that. And what's more, this is perhaps the point that needs to be emphasized. If you are on the re-sacralizing side of things, if you have a concern for the environment, if you are a feminist, if you're part of the human potential movement, if you're a Jungian, whatever that means, then it's important to acknowledge that devotion to economic inequality, something very cruel and nasty, is there as well. We're all implicated in it, me too. And so what I'm trying to do in the lecture is really bring out that there is a point to our devotion to economic inequality. And that point is that by investing, in economic inequality, we can access the benefits of bargaining, negotiating, and the whole free market economic process. But I'm glad you bring in, something from the real world, farm workers and so on and so forth. I think that I'm sort of pre-associated with the idea of farm workers, but I think trade unions and associations of working people are very important here, because they're the only way in which you can get a bargaining process that isn't stacked against the working woman or man from the word go. I don't know whether you're working with them as a trade unionist or something like that, but I think the history of that kind of political organisation is extremely important here. Otherwise, you see, it's the individual, the little guy or little woman, is absolutely at a loss when faced with the big battalions of capitalism. That's why labour organisations, in spite of the fact they are horrifically corrupt all over the world, are really very important. Yes?
I don't know whether this is true in Britain, but there are a number of examples of North American politicians whose careers are virtually ruined because they crack a joke at what's considered an inappropriate time, or in fact display a sense of humour at all. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether we're of that restock a bit, introducing them.
Yes. Absolutely. Well, A, I'm very familiar with the American Continuum a lot, so I know about this.
Although,
Reagan,
you know, when he said that, Chris Thunder, you know? Because he was everybody's good daddy at the time, he got away,
but I know what you're saying. The other thing about it, and this is where we completely evacuated the tricks of the political process, which means we don't get into all that dynamic transformative stuff either, is that it's impossible in our culture for a politician to say, well, actually, I was wrong a few years ago and I changed my mind. Because this reveals him as an immature, unbalanced, inconsistent person who's clearly not individuating, or in English psychology, job achieving the defensive position. I mean, it's incredible that. But you also see it, by the way, you see it to some extent in political theory, psychological theorizing as well. Jung is very, very reluctant to say, well, I got it wrong then. You might say, well, I've moved on, or I now think, but he never actually said that this idea of mine was, you know, came out of a particular context and I shouldn't really bother with it anymore. Because he too is terrified he won't be taken seriously. I mean, this talk is about taking two sets of things seriously. On the one hand, you have to take tricksterism seriously, which is horrid, because it's an insult to trickster taking seriously. And the other thing you have to take seriously, and this is very important in a rich country like this, is economics. So there's a lot. I do recognise, I'm quite pleased with the idea, I can live with it anyway, but this is a difficult paper because it is actually, it's difficult for me to write it too, because it's actually bringing one to a certain kind of threshold. And so on the one hand, take your trickster seriously, on the other hand, take economics seriously, and on the third hand, bring trickster and economics together, it's my body. And yet, somehow, my experience in Leningrad seems to show, tricksterism and free market economic processes do seem to be connected. That you cannot have the goodies, do you have an expression in English? Good things, good outcomes, without staying with and being aware of and even celebrating the bad things. I like that a lot.
Well, what brings to mind for me is that a writer like Milan Kundera. Kundera and Czechoslovakia has a tremendous sense of tricksterism in his writing, while at the same time being deeply conscious of the economic and political system from which he arises. And in a sense, artists in North America tend to envy the Eastern Europeans because the position of the artist there is, in a sense, to provide that trickster element in politics. And now everyone's a little worried that they're going to lose that because somehow in the free market economy, an artist doesn't have that much punch.
You're absolutely, absolutely right. That is something that the artist carries. And another item in the industry here, Joyce Carey, the E, Joyce is the E.
Yeah.
Sorry, horses mouth. Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's a good example of how artists know some of this stuff. Yeah. You see, the paper is about political transformation and resacralization, which I imagine everybody is in favor of. That's my point. And what I'm saying is that even though you're in favor of it, you have to look at where you're not. And if you look at where you're not, you find that this kind of macabre love of standing in the other person. And until the resacralizing movements own that and do something with that and come to terms with the slips around that, they won't, I don't think they'll succeed. But just to round off, well, if you can, I don't mind dialogue at all, but some of the things that are going on in the artistic world in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union do have very interesting links to the sort of situationalists of the 1960s in the States and in Europe. You know, which on the political scene was the 68 Democratic Convention, there was Pig for president, and the other things the newbies did. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think that worked. It didn't make any difference to the political process or the political culture, because there was simply no psychological theorizing going on about it. I mean, why were they doing it? Look at Paris in May 68. And there were amazing slogans going along, like, you know, the earth lies underneath the pavement, meaning rip up the stones and get to the earth, or that politics is something from the imagination. I mean, it's been around, and in a way, it's even in Aristotle,
there is a kind of jokey, sardonic thread running through much political theory. It's definitely Machiavelli.
Well, maybe just one last
note.
Point. This entire society here is built on a very dominant myth. Well, it's the rags to riches story. And I resonate with what you say about our love of economic inequality, because without it you can't have the pauper who gets to marry the princess, or who, you know, the clever servant who manages to better himself, or the immigrant who gets to become president.
Yeah. The only bit I add to that is to say that it's not a kind of unfortunate byproduct of our system that there's economic inequality. It's, you know, it is not something that you can average out and say, well, on balance, free market economics works better than any system. That would be a kind of Jungian approach to it. What I'm saying is you have to really develop the bad side. Stay with it. Thanks. You and then you.
And I was trying to compare it, right, and how this compares to an understanding of Dionysus and the other sort of side of Apollo, and then some of the talk about tearing things down and build something better and making the graves in the mind and stuff. It sort of sounds like it, but I can't distinguish it. And what would you comment on?
Yeah, it's an interesting point that the Apollo Hermes dichotomy and the Apollo Dionysus dichotomy are different dichotomies. That's right. In the longer version of this, I tried to work out what the differences were, but I've forgotten. But I think there are, it's important, there are some. But I think what is quite interesting, I don't know about Dionysus in relation to this, but I think that one of the things about Apollo and Hermes, which you don't find in Apollo and Dionysus, is the gay theme. That although bargaining itself is no way a male phenomenon, clearly, it does seem to me significant that these are two male gods. And the reason why I think it's significant is that you see what's happening in the gay world at the moment. See the gradual emergence of a very serious attempt constructed around the AIDS problem to create and develop non-hierarchic structures of political organization. It's something of historic importance, the way in which the gay community has responded to AIDS. And political theorists really should be studying and learning from it as much as possible. And I think it's somewhere in the way of Apollo and Hermes struggle to find a non-hierarchical way of relating without denying competition between them or the impulse to be at the top of the hierarchy. That's really very interesting, and I connect it up to what's coming out of the age problematic. I don't know if that makes any sense. Whereas the Apollo Dionysus connection seems to me to be I can't read it quite that way. I can't call that very much. But I do think that in terms of, in terms of learning something about new approaches to political organisation, the gay aspect of this is important. Because, you see, Hermes and Apollo, as a couple, resist a cheap complementary approach, you know? Which, a complementary approach means that everything Hermes is, Apollo is not. And everything Apollo is, Hermes is not. So that if you rammed Apollo and Hermes together, you'd have an individuated human being. That's not how it seems to be working between them. They're doing their own thing, if you like, in relation to Apollo. So I think there's a lot there. And by the way, this is something that I'll be taking up in my workshop tomorrow on the fathers, looking at, one of the many things I'll be looking at, non-hierarchic male psychological and political organizations. And I basically take fathers rather broadly. But we can come back to it. My answer is stimulated by your question rather than it being an answer to your question. Do you want to say anything?
I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah. I see no problem in leaving Dionysus in there somewhere, but as yet I haven't really tried to do it. You see, I'm actually not, to be honest with you, I'm not that interested in the bloody Greek gods.
And lie as part of a program. They're not tricky to advance certain politics. They don't have goals like that. They just lie and cheat because that's how they are and who they are. Leaders who do lie and cheat as part of a program and to advance policy. And here we have to learn from the experiences of dissidents and independent spirits in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union who developed a profound cynicism that enabled them to read between the lines. We need to acquire this skill urgently. Now to Hermes. Hermes is a trickster of a different order than the Winnebago trickster, and we grasp something more specific about politics from his myth. We grasp something about capitalism and the market economy. Hermes is certainly deceitful and criminal, but as we shall see in the myth, the accent is equally on his constructive and transformative nature. After all, Hermes is a god, guide of souls to the underworld, divinity of olive cultivation, athletics, boundaries, commerce, and indeed messenger of the gods. Hermes is a liminal presence on the threshold of depth psychology and politics. And Hermes also shows that the trickster and the market economy are somehow connected. In the myth of Hermes, we hear of the deceit and lying of Hermes. This inspires associations to the ruthlessness of economic inequality, to stock market fraud and insider trading. We also hear in the myth of the capacity of Hermes to bargain and negotiate. That inspires associations to the potential in liberal democracy to avoid tyranny and gross injustice. Let's consider both of these in turn. Remember, the goal is to establish a more credible psychological analysis of economic themes. And these themes, economics, are quite frankly not usually addressed by depth psychologists and certainly not by Jungian analysts. It's a tragic lack, I think, when one considers the colonial and neo-colonial connections between economics, economic inequality, and war. Well, it's now time to take a closer look at the hermetic patterns of our economic dilemma. You know, myths suggest patterns for more than inner forces. Joseph Campbell once said that myths are social dreams, and I say myths are political fantasies. In the Homeric hymn to Hermes, on the first day of his life, Hermes leaps up to look for meat. Pausing only to kill a turtle and fashion a lyre from its shell, he steals 50 head of cattle from the herd of Apollo, his half-brother. Hermes drives the cattle backwards so that their tracks seem to point away from his stables. Tricky, huh? According to the Homeric hymn, Hermes was the inventor of fire, and he roasts two of the animals he has stolen, making a sacrifice of this meat to the other gods. Understandably, Apollo is very upset that his cattle have been taken, and he quickly works out what must have happened. Charles Bower's brilliant modern translation, which they may have outside, conveys Apollo's agitation. "Listen, kid, lying in your cradle, tell me where my cows are, and quick, we're going to fight this out, and it won't be very pretty." Hermes is innocence itself. How could a milk-sucking baby do such a thing? And as he says, "After all, I was just born yesterday." It doesn't fool Apollo, though. He says, "You trickster, you trickster, you sharpie. The way you talk, I bet you've broken into a lot of expensive homes in nights past." It's in humorous vein still, and Apollo prophesies that Hermes will come to a bad end. Hermes sticks to his guns and goes on denying the theft. The two gods present themselves before Zeus. Apollo accuses, Hermes says not guilty. But to Zeus, obviously everything is clear, and with a laugh, he orders the two of them to try to sort out their differences. Now, I'll return in a minute to the narrative of the Homeric hymn to Hermes. What I want to do now is to react psychologically to the story so far and reflect on its political implications. The myth amplifies our devotion to the economic realities of capitalism. How we want, really want, inequality, cheating, and injustice between individuals, groups, nations, and regions. Our devotion to economic inequality has something to do with the space for symbolization. What I mean is that the wealthier the individual, family, clan, class, nation, region becomes, the greater the space for symbolization seems to be. One can afford movies, the theater, opera, eating in restaurants, driving in cars, and even personal analysis. These are activities which secure and provide the space for symbolization. Of course, this display of differentiation is completely illusory. I'm not saying that the space is really taken advantage of, and I'm certainly not saying that the well-off are enjoying richer inner lives or that the richer countries are spiritually richer. But the illusion that they are is hypnotic. In economic inequality, there are located personal and national hopes for the richness of the symbolic life. We believe this emotionally, even though we know intellectually that such richness cannot be bought, whether by women or men or corporations or governments. Rich people and rich countries do not necessarily have rich consciences. To quote from the Tao of Politics again, if you are not satisfied with yourself, even if you have a whole continent for your house, with all its people for your servants, this will not be enough to support you. In the rich countries of the West, in America, in Britain, we have to face that in spite of the growing disgust, we are still caught in a collective love affair with a rotten social order and an unfeeling culture. We made our commitment to this a long time ago, and however much we may know intellectually that it doesn't work for us on the ethical level, we can't seem to break our tie to our lover, and I call our lover economic inequality. It is a deep guilt over the undeniable fact of economic inequality that takes us to the cheating heart of global capitalism, the partner we refuse to leave, remaining locked in a relationship whose oily tensions are currently driving us crazy. We see the link between economic inequality and emotional isolation in those modern legends, modern myths of Howard Hughes and Paul Getty. In Hermes's case, and I think here he really does represent the unconscious motivation of the modern business tycoon, in Hermes's case, he goes home to see his mother. He tells her of his plans to be the most successful capitalist ever. I'm capable, mother, certainly to be thief number one. Now, so far, we've been looking at one part of the Hermes story. I suggested that the myth was a psychological patterning of the unjust and inequitable aspects of market economy capitalism. The myth illumined our investment in such corruption. Yet, the rest of the myth brings out that there is another side. For there is more in humanity than a collective love of a rotten world order and an unfeeling culture. There is also in humanity a collective love of a healthy world order and a commitment to a just culture concerned with the well-being of all its members. There is absolutely no contradiction, you see. Both of these exist side by side. Collective love of a healthy world order and a collective love of a rotten world order. Both sets of human traits are patterned in the Hermes story. And I want to state my argument once more. In our age that seeks to re-sacralize in both the capitalist West and the once communist East, it seems very hard to go beyond our split emotional attitude to the market economy and economic inequality. What follows next in the Hermes story may be taken as a metaphor for the kind of constructive and creative relationship capitalism supports rather well. The I-thou aspect of market relations between people or peoples are revealed alongside the ruthless aspect, compassion functioning alongside competition. Let's get back to the narrative of the Homeric hymn to Hermes. Remember, we got to the point where Zeus has told Apollo and Hermes to come to terms. Well, Zeus has really made it quite impossible now for Hermes to conceal the theft any longer. Apollo, reunited with 48 head of cattle, decides to tie Hermes up, perhaps as a prelude to further punishment. To the sun god's amazement, the thongs he has placed round Hermes' ankles suddenly extend to tie up all the cattle. This trick of Hermes's can be compared with Trickster's use of his penis in the Winnebago cycle of stories. To placate his older brother, Hermes then plays him a tune on his lyre. Apollo is quite transfixed by its beauty, which is unlike any music known before. At this point, Apollo relents. He states his intention, which is now shifted. He doesn't want to punish him anymore. He states his new intention, which is to make Hermes his protege. Apollo will be a kind of theatrical agent for Hermes. He will be an impresario, granting space for his musical gifts. Apollo promises Hermes the roles of soul guide and messenger of the gods. But in the pecking order, in this idea of Apollo's, Hermes will most certainly be underneath Apollo. I think Apollo wanted the kind of deal that Colonel Parker struck with Elvis Presley. The god of capitalism is to be a wage slave. Well, Hermes's response to this suggestion is to come up with a revolutionary counter-suggestion. He'll give the lyre to Apollo if Apollo will give him the cattle. And Hermes also takes Apollo up on the job of soul guide and messenger. They make a bargain, you see. They make a bargain. And in a way, imaginally, it is the first bargain. And the implications for the market economy, for liberal democracy, and for global politics are immense. Exchange and mutuality are now highlighted by the myth. Enlightened self-interest can benefit both parties. Hermes, the cheating trickster, makes a constructive contribution to political thought. Apollo installs Hermes as being in charge of exchanges among men on the nourishing earth. Being no fool, Apollo also makes Hermes swear an oath not to do it again. Hermes does so, and Apollo then gives him the caduceus, the famous staff of the messenger. Now, in this transaction, neither god is altered. You see, gods don't change. It's a bargain, not a transformation. And it wouldn't have occurred without the earlier cheating, stealing, and lying. Both sides of our image and evaluation of the market economy have equal existence. That's what the Hermes myth tells us. Moreover, they have equally significant psychologies. And as we've seen, to be able to hold these two psychologies in mind means something different from striving for a conjunction, synthesis, or balance of them. You can't just dispense with the psychology of theft so as to enjoy the psychology of bargaining. There is a psychological coexistence here, acceptance of which opens up the possibility of exploring the social and political implications of these sibling economic modes: cheating, lying, and stealing, bargaining, and negotiating. It's important not to idealize the bargaining process. Apollo and Hermes do not cease to eye each other cautiously. There are many different styles of bargaining, and bargaining should not be seen as an exclusively masculine or male phenomenon. In fact, what empirical studies exist about bargaining and negotiating suggest that females are rather better at it than males. Alongside the desire to make a good deal, the bargaining process supports and fosters compassion for the other, without whom there would be no bargaining possible. Montesquieu put it like this, and remember his influence on your founding fathers: wherever the ways of men are gentle, there is commerce, and wherever there is commerce, the ways of men are gentle. The bargaining process can be exhilarating, fun, and sexy, and that is an important part of its psychological viability. The relevance of these ideas about negotiation and bargaining for the resolution of warlike conflict was rather ably summarized by my 4-year-old son. I don't think he'd ever heard me talk about this, but one day, a couple of weeks ago, he said, "Daddy, I want to tell you something. It's about a bargain. A bargain is all standing round in a circle and asking if we can stop fighting." You know, I'm not really sure I can explain to you why bargaining and negotiating, that side of economic life, cannot be split off from stealing, cheating, and lying. It's just, that's the way it seems to be in the collective psyche. When I gave this talk in Leningrad, after the question session, the audience formed themselves into what they called an experiential group, and I sat in silence with an interpreter just behind me whispering into my ear the whole time. And for a couple of hours, the Russian audience explored just this point. They somehow knew, and were very uneasy about it, but knew that they couldn't have all the things they wanted from the free market if they didn't also engage with lying, with cheating, with stealing, and with criminality. It seems to be a connection that can't be overlooked. It also seems that questions of economics do lie at the heart of a psychological engagement with processes of political change, especially nonviolent political change. The problem of a more equal distribution of wealth has everything to do with the power relations within a single society or in the world as a whole, and hence with political organization. Political organization, in its turn, simply cannot be cut off from whatever psychological processes of resacralization might be taking place. Now, at this point, as the end is now about 5 minutes away, it makes sense to try to draw the various themes of the paper together. And I realize it's a complex, dense paper. So I'm going to try and really, I suppose, crudely summarize it. I began by saying that there's a process of resacralization going on in Western culture, and that the same is true of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union as well. Then I said that those who seek to link depth psychology with politics, like me, should admit that they too are caught up in the resacralizing process. Resacralization is essentially a secularization of the divine, but, this was my first big point, I guess, resacralization is threatened by a massive split in our image of and attitude towards the market economy. Disgust with ourselves and confusion about the inequalities of world capitalism and the market economy fuel the urgency of addressing the split if we are really serious about wanting resacralization to occur. Machiavelli addresses many of these issues in The Prince. Here we find that the essence of politics is to know how to be evil when necessary without anyone thinking you are evil. It's a trick. Machiavelli's politicization of the shadow led us to the trickster and his role in processes of political change. Hermes is a special kind of trickster, and I suggested that exploring the Hermes myth helps us with our splits and confusions about capitalism and the market economy. Hermes speaks for both the inequitable, unjust, cheating side and the creative, transformative, compassionate side of the market. So Hermes is a passageway to a depth psychological engagement with the political dynamics of the economic system. Now that was a summary of the paper so far. Approaching the end, I want to return once again to the connections between depth psychology and politics with which I began. These concern everyone involved in the clinical practice of analysis, whether as analyst or patient, or indeed those people involved in self-reflection. You see, it would be a pity, even a tragic pity, certainly a mistake, to restrict the political significance of Hermes to the impersonal, collective, global level of politics. There's also a pressing personal and individual level here. Because by engaging with Hermes, we also have to engage with the warring sides of our own Hermes selves. On the one hand, our fraud, our criminality, our belief in magic, our love of economic inequality, our own depression-inducing violence. And on the other hand, our capacity for exchange, integrity, relatedness, flexibility, our love of dignity and freedom, and our desire to reject coercion and bullying. Hermes, the god of boundaries, incites us to challenge the boundaries that are conventionally accepted to exist between the external world and the internal world. He incites us to challenge the boundaries that are conventionally accepted to exist between life and reflection, between doing and being, between politics and psychology, between public and private, between the political development of the individual and the psychological development of the individual. I'll conclude the paper with a warning and an exhortation. This is the warning. It is not enough simply to want to introduce the political level into depth psychology. One has to engage first with political and economic thought and process. One cannot leap to ideas of political development, the political drive, and so forth, without first travelling alongside the likes of Machiavelli, Trickster, and Hermes. That's the warning. You can't just do it. The exhortation, travelling this route, has led me to conclude that we need to envision a completely new relationship between the private and the public, between the intimate and the crowded, between the secret and the open, between introversion and extroversion, between the vulgar and the numinous. Using a theatrical metaphor, we need a crowd on stage and a crowd in the audience. On that crowded stage are individuals who offer their most secret truths to individuals within that crowded audience, sharing a collective political experience with them. Thank you very much.
To be honest with you, I'm not that interested in the bloody Greek gods. Okay? I mean, I've never written about them before, and I don't think I'll ever do it again. It just struck me that for once, old-fashioned Jungian method might have something to offer. Don't even father, you know? Yes, do it.
I just wanted to struggle with more of the relationship between the shadow and the trickster.
Yes.
It seems the success of your paper in terms of whether it can afford a new reality, political reality, hinges on that fact that can somehow distinguish between the shadow and the trickster.
Yes.
And while I was thinking about that and how personally difficult that is for me, your paper reminded me of the name of the road, the book, where the whole drama of covert activities, murder, political intrigue, and final annihilation centered around the discovery of a book by Aristotle on humor.
Yes.
And how the forces of the Christian Church, embodied by this particular old monk, bent everything towards preventing that book from being released.
Yes.
And it seems to me that you're wrestling with the same problem when you say, all we've got to do is stamp out and eliminate those forces and we can have a new vision of political reality. But also, like the name of Rose point out, you know, demonstrate the huge difficulties involved and the simple exhortation that can do that doesn't seem to me to be enough of an underpinning for a paper like this.
Yeah. Yeah, you're saying there's two things. One is you're linking what I'm doing in the paper to things like Mayor Rose and missing sort of human dimension, but you're complaining using what theoretical underpinning?
Not theoretical underpinning. Maybe it seems to be much more pressing than a theoretical problem.
Yeah.
The problem of our Christian heritage is really, I mean, you just don't stand that out and get a new vision of reality.
No, I understand. Well, I suppose what I would say is this, that the paper, in a sense, is hopefully a good and intelligent description. And in a way, that's the element of tradition. I spotted something, I think, that is going on anyway, below the surface, at the level of unconsciousness. And that has to do with the way in which our culture, I can't speak for other cultures, seems to have got into a very complicated interweaving between lying, cheating, and stealing, and some kind of political transformative activity, which I call desacralization. And we've got into this complicated situation, panic and split. That's roughly what I'm getting at. Now, my point is that all along the way there has been some celebration, or at least recognition, of the political potential of the irrational. As you say, as I say from Aristotle onwards, you bring in the missing book. And I think what I'm trying to do is form this realization of a hidden strand in political theory into what's kind of I call the text. Now you could say, unitinically.
I understand what you've done, I think. What I'm saying is, can we discriminate that thread, which is celebratory in nature, from the shadow in any other way other than an academic way? I can't.
Well, yes.
It's a very, very personal way that.
Yeah, I think you probably can. First of all, there's the question of individual judgment. But secondly, you know, what's come to my mind in response to the question, which I haven't thought about this before, is aesthetics. But I don't personally find anything that tricksters do ugly. Where I found quite a lot of modern political endeavor very ugly. Or I can tell my own political imagery and motivation, I can do it too. And as we know, the aesthetic is actually quite a good guide here for the shadow. That's very much part of both Jewish and Christian moral traditions. So I think you can stay within what you call Christian heritage or Christian culture, Judeo Christian culture, and you can let an aesthetic dimension come in here. So I think that's one way one could try and achieve what we're talking about. But if I'm absolutely honest with you, this question of precise distinction, what is trickster and what is shadow, that doesn't worry me as much as it does you. But that's okay. Don't say more.
No, I thought that was interesting.
You could have quite answered my question. Are you saying that the papers like mine and my paper was or wasn't academic? Or was and wasn't?
Well, I haven't got that far with your whole paper, which I found interesting. But it's just around that point of what I think is a necessary distinction to be made between the shadow and the trickster.
Yes.
But can't be done as easily as it can be done academically, can't be done in real life as easily. And my personal experience is that no. And that where individuals certainly need help is some concrete practical guidelines where the distinction can be made in actual life.
Yes.
You know, like at the time that you're involved in a negotiation and you feel like cheating.
Yes.
Is that an operation of the trickster or are you caught up in the devil? Yeah, you know, that's the very real question, because the outcome is crucial in a real negotiation, whether the cheater is something that's going to produce a revelation in your life, which is the trickster, or whether it's going to send us all to hell.
Yeah, well, now,
and how does an individual distinguish that?
Let me take up the question, not in the spirit of response, I can't answer that, or even in the spirit of argument, which is to start up about and talk about it a little bit. So what really starts to come up in my mind is that you're identifying something even more precisely than I am, and putting it in terms of a cultural or religious tradition. And then there's also in terms of personal implications, which is that we have inherited a value system that says, when you are engaged in a negotiation and you feel the impulse to cheat, steal, and lie, you are doing something satanic, evil, etc. And I think what I would want to say is, if you invest fully in cheating, stealing, and lying, then the good things, the transformative, the positive, the sacralizing things, are more guaranteed, or they receive more of a kind of kickstart than if you try to evacuate cheating, stealing, and lying from your relationship. Yes? I guess what I'm saying is the devil does have to choose.
You're talking about playing poker.
Go on.
When you play poker, you know you're going to cheat. That's part of the game. It's bluffing. And it's not, it doesn't know the evil intent. It's part of the fun of the game. Is that what
you're talking about? Yes. It's helpful to see what you're doing is the same. So that your expectation is, so that the impulse to cheat or to bluff are very specific personal examples of the kind of thing I'm seeing as trickstery politics, and I'm seeing as leading to or being implicated with all the kind of more idealistic and optimistic sounding things. Yes?
That's right. David comes from the trickster.
Yes.
I think so, yes.
I feel like what we're talking about that a little bit, what I've gotten to see in the opening of your talk was something, and I didn't even write this down as a beginning, about how complex the ability of words to choose freely. And it went on, I don't have my notes here, to choose freely and exercise the choices that they make, rather than being bound in the shadow, so that they can't access the things that they need.
The bit of this level is that isn't, in that section, what I say is that power operates on two levels at least. One is a public and political level, and the other is a more personal level, which has to do with how free to act people feel. In other words, look, basically, I learned this one from feminists. You know, the old feminist slogan of the 70s, the personal is political, which you've all heard. And this opening section, you'll remember it, is a kind of an expansion of that. Now, what feminist concentration on personal being political taught us is there is no point in constructing something around power that is exclusively couched in public societal terms. That there is something about political power for it that affects individuals too. And that's why at the end of the paper, I turn it away from Hermes as a metaphor for capitalism and look at Hermes as a metaphor for ourselves, the two sides of ourselves that can't be synthesized and balanced up. So it's really about understanding that politics has its public dimension and its private dimension, and that they are somehow linked in everyday life, goes back to your point. And once you start getting into that linkage between the political and the personal, then the psychologist should be present. Now, my criticism of Jungian psychology is implicit in this paper, not explicit, but you have to be kind of moronic not to hear it. I mean, it's obvious, isn't it? That is what we've not done. Not only have we not been political, we've made a divide between the two kinds of empowerment. You know, big resources like oil, that's politics. Personal dilemmas between men and women, or between people, that's neurosis. I don't know if that answers what you're getting at. Yes, sorry, I tend to get stuck in one segment of an audience.
If the trickster is in society, for example, like Chaplin in Wild Times, he finds himself in there, or Schweik,
yeah.
Schweik is a real example, right? He's saving his neck, right? They have to survive in that system, and so doing they infiltrate and they just start to destroy the system, but they have no choice. But see, I don't know, it's what do you think about
that? What I think is that the global challenges to the system that sensible people castigate as immature are in fact sensible. What psychologists should be doing is putting to their shoulders to a certain kind of wheel that says, imaginative gestures are down to earth. Passive resistance is extremely potent. You know, if you think about Schweik, he's a non-Gandhian passive resistor.
Yes,
when his boss kicked him, it's a very interesting thing. So for me, my response to your question is the role of the psychologist here is what I think starts to be to actually take a stand and put whatever he or she has learned psychologically or theorized psychologically or feels emotionally into discussions about politics. But see, when psychologists do get involved with politics, it tends to be on things, on studies of, for example, where do political leaders come in the order of siblings in their family? You know, there's a lot of that kind of psychological politics going on, yeah? So I'm sort of sympathizing with what you think, getting at.
Mm-hmm. So the psychologist then should liberate the trickster within society to make a change?
I suppose what I would say is that the depth psychologist, the Jungian analyst, should extend to the political realm the same kind of tolerance for idiosyncrasy, quirkiness, irrationality, bloody-mindedness that he or she extends to the individual patients.
But that's not what happens. Now, where are we on the time? I mean, I'm happy to go on until you want to go home. But I don't want to go on beyond the time when you want to go home.
We're actually past both times of the call.
I see. So what do we do now? The three hands go up and we're past the time. I mean, that's a nice feeling. I think it's good to stop when you're ahead of the game, actually. So I'll declare my end of this closed.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Ewing Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.